Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.
I'm your host, as always, Michael Avery, and today we've got a truly special regular guest, someone whose work has challenged the status quo, not just in banking, but in the way we think about the world itself. I'm really thrilled to sit down with David Buckham, the CEO of Monocle Solutions and author of the highly anticipated Orthogonal Thinking, My Search for Meaning in Mathematics, Literature and Life. And many of you might already be familiar with David's earlier works, The End of Money, Unequal and Why Banks Fail, where he meticulously examined global inequality, big themes, systemic issues in banking and the pitfalls of fractional reserve banking as well. But today we're shifting gears into something far more personal. Orthogonal Thinking is what I found to be an extraordinary departure from his previous books. It's a journey that fuses memoir, philosophy, mathematics, and literature into a single narrative, a reflection of David's quest for meaning. In Orthogonal Thinking, David weaves together the worlds of mathematics and literature, using his own life experience to explore some of the biggest existential questions that I think we all face, ultimately. What makes his book so compelling is how it integrates historical figures like Carl Friedrich Gauss and J.M. Coetzee with abstract mathematical theories like Cantor's infinities and Gödel's incompleteness theorem, offering a truly unique lens through which to understand human existence and our pursuit of truth in a world where I think truth is becoming rather more elusive in what we call a post-truth environment. So join me as we dive into this fascinating conversation with David Buckham. We're going to unpack the concept of orthogonal thinking, explore how seemingly unrelated disciplines can offer profound insights, and reflect on how personal experiences shape our intellectual pursuits. David, it's just a wonderful, wonderful work, and clearly a deeply personal experience for you. But at the same time, this is something that must have been sitting in your brain for years, percolating, was it?
Yes, Michael, thank you so much. It's such a privilege to have this conversation. So when people ask me sometimes, how long did it take you to write Orthogonal Thinking? I'll say, well, if I go into my open files, it would have been probably from about March, April of last year. But the true answer to the question of how long it took to write this book is 30 years. It's not possible to write a book like this without thinking about it for 30 years. So these issues or these ideas that I've had or these insights, for example, when I first understood Cantor's proof of multiple infinities, when I first understood what Cantor had done, I think I say it in the book, is I walked around in a daze on the university campus, sort of thinking, well, everyone should know this, and then realizing that some people know this and this changes everything, you know, and it was such an insight. And I sort of, over the years, I've tried to explain his proof to friends of mine, and people sometimes listen and people sometimes don't, and sometimes I'm not successful at explaining it. But finally, you know, also, for example, Gödel's incompleteness theorem, or when I first understood what Noam Chomsky was proposing with universal grammar, and when I first understood what Michel Foucault was proposing with his theory of epistemes, and when I watched Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and I understood the postmodern movement, or I thought I did, and, you know, when I read John Barth, or when I started to understand what postmodernism is and how it's influenced my thinking and what I've observed over the last 30 years, is so mind-blowing that I've always wanted to kind of write it down. And then I decided to kind of weave it into kind of a personal story that I would make a kind of travel story with a, you know, a little bit of a love story and a little bit of a, you know, a little bit of a suspenseful story. And it just came out of me in one great rush of creativity. And it was definitely the most pleasure I've ever taken in writing a book.
And as a reader, probably the most pleasure I've taken in reading your book so far, because it stretches you. And I think often that is the role of the creative mind, be it the artist, be it the writer, is it takes you and it takes what you think you know of the world, and then it stretches you and remolds your outlook, and you exit the process transformed to some extent. And I remember when you first started telling me about the book, our first trip to the Cedarburg, and it was really difficult at the time to fully visualize, because it is such an exploration that touches on, I think some might find the maths a little bit mind-bending, but then you go into, you know, the literary influences that you've had. And interestingly, and I want to come back to the influence of Joyce, because he writes very non-linear narratives. And some of the style of this book, I think, seems to be you're quite influenced by Joyce as well. But let's just start with this idea of orthogonal thinking, which you define as thinking perpendicularly, but holding two distinct but not necessarily opposing thoughts at the same time. How did this first arrive to you as a way through which to unpack the meaning of, yes, of life?
Yes, it's such a great question. I was in Europe skiing, walking up a slope, carrying my skis in town. I think I'd gone with a friend snow skiing and someone in France in the French Alps. And I was explaining that in my mathematical training, because I'm trained as a mathematician and we use mathematical modeling methodologies in certain ways, and that I had inadvertently been using this mathematical modeling methodology far wider than just in maths to her, my friend. And she said, and we call the process of creating orthogonal vectors, we call them orthogonal vectors. And I was trying to explain to her how useful it is to think of orthogonal vectors, to think outside of the narrative in which one is steeped. So if you think about it, we tend to be quite extreme in our political views. We tend to be quite intolerant of views that are different to ours, mm-hmm. particularly in today's world. And we are very much narrow-casted. So whatever we like, we are reinforced with by social media and by our friendships. Mm-hmm. And we are very intolerant. You know, it's always very surprising to find a friend that has a different view back from school days. And you could, like, you go to your partner and go, I can't believe what Tony just told me. Yeah. Can you believe he believes in XYZ?
Co-opted into these grand narratives or meta-narratives, as you say.
Yeah. So I find it very useful to think of orthogonal vectors in a mathematical sense, but in also a philosophical or a psychological sense. So when someone is saying something and someone else has a different view, it's the ability to look at both of those arguments and both of those views and to think perpendicularly away from them. So it gives one a kind of psychological distance and an ability to see the whole problem differently and to not be so taken in by one narrative or by its polar opposite narrative. It's a fun way, it's a more fun way, it's a more amusing way, and it's a more useful way, I think, to think. So I was telling her about this and she said, you should write a book about it. And I started working on the book then. And then I put it away and I then really applied my mind early this year. I had a target to write a lyrical piece and then a very mathematical or a very technical piece. So I kind of want to suck the reader in so that they listen to the argument, because I can't explain this way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And like when we were in the Cedarburg, Michael, you'll remember that I was standing there with the whiskey in my hand till midnight in front of a fire explaining to you what I meant the book to say.
And I think I grasped it for a fleeting moment underneath those Cedarburg stars. And then I woke in the morning, and just as the stars had disappeared, so had that grasp, until I actually had the book in front of me. And, you know, you actually say in the beginning of the book, this is, with all due respect, dear reader, the shortest distance from here to hoping I've opened the doors of perception almost to understand what orthogonal thinking is. Truly remarkable.
Thank you. Yeah. It's unfortunately one of those books where if I could say it in fewer words, I would. So I can't. And I think the best way to read it, and it's the same I've said to Exclusive Books and to Jacana, the distributor, and to Burnett Media, the publisher, is just put the book at the front of the bookshop, and that way people will see it. Because if you put it in a section, which section of the bookshop would you put it in? You know, Would you put it in biography? Would you put it in philosophy, psychology, travel, science?
That's all of those, you know, exactly. But I guess, again, people will take from it what they want to, but I certainly read a great deal of philosophy and existential philosophy. Albert Camus certainly springs to mind, and I know he was an influence in your early years at UCT studying English literature. And he wrote extensively about the absurd and how our search for meaning in an indifferent universe is actually, it's really sometimes quite futile. You mentioned the concept of this dualist almost approach, orthogonal thinking, as a way to perceive the world differently. Do you think that's a response to this existential absurdity that Camus wrote about, or maybe serve a different purpose?
Yes. So, I mean, if you think about organized religion, or if you think about philosophers, you could broadly say that some people believe in an interventionist God, right? Or some people believe that going to church is enough. And then they don't believe, like my aunt, for example, who's a psychiatrist in Boston. She led a synagogue service on a ship that I was on recently with my parents. And she was reading orthogonal thinking, and she said, "So, David, I mean, you know, I'm an atheist." So I said, "Well, you just led a service on the ship." So she'd be an example of an orthogonal thinker in the sense that she doesn't believe in certain things that a Christian Judaic belief system would believe in. So I search in the philosophers for other ways of interpreting our place in the world. And one of those ways is Camus, who believed that the effort one would put in to attempting to understand one's place in the world is so pointless that it's absurd. So it's like the myth of Sisyphus, you know, that was his philosophy. It's an absurd venture to even attempt to understand the world. When I used to go rock climbing in my 20s and I'd walk up the hill with my physicist friends who were all studying string theory and, you know, they were all studying particle physics and it was very exciting. And, you know, there was 26 dimensional non-Euclidean geometry that we were using to solve for the God particle or the grand unified theory. And I was listening to all of this stuff and often just fearing the climb that was to come, keeping my mouth shut and listening to my genius friends talk about string theory, which is now, you know, without offending string theorists, it hasn't yielded very much. I mean, Sheldon Cooper, famously in Big Bang Theory, in episode 9, I think, says his life's work has been pointless. You know, and if you think of Noam Chomsky, who posited that there must be a universal grammar because it's self-evident that human beings can acquire language and create infinite meaning. But when asked many, many, many times, well, then where is it, this universal grammar? Where do we find it? You know, he evaded the question as to whether it's a biological or an innate capability, thereby evading the question of, you know, evolution. But yet it is true what he says, because there must be a universal grammar because we do acquire language infinitely. But why? And then you read a Yuval Hariri and he says, because, you know, the female folk sat in a cave and gossiped. I personally am not satisfied with that particular answer. And then you've got, on the other hand, Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida and Jacques Lacan, the French philosophers of the 60s and 70s, who were like, no, 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 guys, your desire to understand a fundamental truth about the universe or yourselves or of human nature is pointless, but not pointless so that we're absurd. You're forgetting that you're steeped in an episteme, in your own story, in your own meta-narrative, and that actually there are just dominant meta-narratives at one time or another that are competing with each other. And the latest meta-narrative that has failed is called science. And we're now going to probably be entering a new meta-narrative. So now you've got an entire belief system which says that, and he's got a lot of good evidence, Michel Foucault, that science itself and our ideas of human nature, and he traces the history of human bondage and the clinic. He's written many fascinating books. But essentially what sits behind that is nihilism, a belief in nothing.
Yeah.
So my book, Orthogonal Thinking, attempts to kind of present in a non-offensive way.
Well, it's a rebuttal. I saw it as a rebuttal of nihilism and postmodernism in particular.
100%.
I mean, Nietzsche 100%. Famously critiquing nihilism proposed the idea of creating one's own values. So I almost see this as a tool for overcoming nihilism in a similar way that Nietzsche advocated for the Übermensch to create meaning. And I really
very
hope-
flattered that you're comparing me to Nietzsche, but yes, very flattered. I mean, Michael, that's exactly it. Is if you believe in nothing, if you're a nihilist, then you can do whatever you like. There is no moral recourse.
Yeah.
Then Michel Foucault can propagate theories. And unfortunately, I believe very, very strongly that those theories became baked into the academic atmosphere of the time and have now become dominant theories and dominant ways of thinking that we don't even realize now how absent our lives are of meaning, particularly in the last 30 years.
In that, you discuss Gödel's incompleteness theorem. When you try and unpack all of this existential uncertainty, remarking how inside the heart of mathematics exists unsolvable paradoxes, I think it's on page 23, and it seems to mirror Jean-Paul Sartre's existential notion of the absurd as well, where life lacks that inherent meaning, but we must find meaning in that uncertainty. So how does this paradox of Gödel's theorem align with this existential uncertainty that Sartre spoke about? And, you know, the idea here that you see mathematical paradoxes as existential challenges that human must grapple with, I found absolutely fascinating. Where did that idea come from?
So when we think of mathematics, and we think of it being the purest of sciences, and we tend to believe, or most people believe, that the foundations of science and of culture and of everything that exists is based on a formal set of truths that are immutable. And the fact is that they're not. When I first understood that when you superimpose Zeno's paradox onto set theory, which for the layperson basically means, you know, all Greeks are liars, I am Greek, am I lying? When you superimpose that quite simple Greek paradox onto different mathematical structures, you get to a point where you get a mathematical system that in which you can create statements that are neither provable nor disprovable, but which are true. Which means to say, and when you read Cantor's proofs of there being multiple infinities, I mean, there were mathematicians that committed suicide. Bertrand Russell went and wrote Principia Mathematica. He spent 325 pages defining the number one just to circumvent these paradoxes, only for Gödel in 1931 to prove that the entire project of Principia Mathematica was internally inconsistent. So you might say, people listening to this might go, oh my God, this is definitely a little bit outside of what I want to be reading about. But I want to appeal to the reader and say, just bear with me a little bit, because you'll understand that it's fundamentally important to understand that there is no central truth that we know of in mathematics. There's nothing that we can be entirely sure about. Nor is there in language or literature or art or in even human nature. We don't know where language comes from. Anyone who says that we know where language comes from is lying
or taking a huge stab in the dark at it. David, and I was going to ask you, in writing orthogonal thinking, what impact did you hope to have on your readers? Is there a specific mindset shift that you wish to inspire, especially given the polarization and the complexity that we see in the world today and this tendency, as you say, for us to be hooked onto these idea trains or these grand meta-narratives and where that could potentially lead us as society?
Yes, I think I'd like to sort of say that I would hope that a person gets to the end of the book and they reject the nihilistic impulse that has infected our thinking and our culture and our culture wars and our geopolitics. So I have like a very grand hope, which is that I would like people to see like the beauty in the uncertainty and the beauty in their own lives, so that they can enjoy life more and enjoy searching for belief and enjoy the beauty of this incredible construct that we have called human nature. Because a lot of people, I think, just simply accept that there are people out there who worry about the meaning of life and things like that, but they just sort of go along with their lives. And I'm saying, in your daily life, you will notice, if you look, signs of infinite, undeniable beauty. And that's why I show, towards the end of the book, I get into the Riemann hypothesis, and I show that there's an incontestable beauty to the Riemann hypothesis that wasn't there. It wasn't put by man. It was not made up. And you can say the same about the night sky. You can look at the night sky with an astronomical eye, or you can look at the night sky with an astrological eye, but you're still looking at the night sky. You know, so you can use whatever edifice of knowledge or edifice of belief you have, but you can't contest the beauty of it. And you can't tell me that we're just here in a humdrum manner. And I think if people believe that they have meaning in their lives, like Viktor Frankl shows in his very beautiful book, Man's Search for Meaning, and that was followed up by The Doctor and the Soul, he describes the story of the three nurses. And, you know, they all three do the same thing, but the first nurse says, what does she do? And she says she cleans up bedpans and dirty patients. And the second one says she applies medicine. And the third one says that she relieves pain and makes people's lives better. They're all three doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So the purpose of orthogonal thinking would be to kind of encourage people to look at their own history and their own lives and just be amazed by the beauty of their own lives, as opposed to being forlorn and as opposed to being negative and as opposed to believing in anything.
Yeah. And why I said it, I certainly saw it as a rebuttal of nihilism and that postmodernism that does tend to lead you down that cul-de-sac for no good. Back to the lyrical structure of the book. And it is written in this wonderful way where you bounce between giving the reader some historical facts around these famous mathematicians and then also your own personal journey, which I must say was one that was shaped all over the world, taking gap years and ayahuasca and kind of enlightenment and all of these things that kind of coalesce around the story, which is fantastic. But I mentioned that the structure of Ulysses kind of struck me when I read this because of the nonlinear narrative structures. Is this something that you did intentionally?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think Ulysses is a great example of a book where, you know, the purpose of the book is to demonstrate the bravery that a simple man in Dublin going through his daily life is as significant as the journey that Ulysses took in the Odyssey, you know, in that the everyday person is, in fact, a kind of Greek hero in his own life, you know, and the rambling thoughts of the hero of Ulysses, who's going from pub to pub and thinking about his wife and thinking about all of these mundane things in his life, is actually like a Greek hero from a Greek tragedy, or on a journey of the Odyssey. So it was kind of my attempt at describing the moments in my life where I had enormous self-doubt. And I was enormously open to new ideas. And often, I think sometimes in our early 20s, maybe our late teens, where, you know, someone could make me believe something that I would never believe, you know.
I think that's true for so many of us, isn't it, though, David? At that stage in our lives, we leave the comfort of the home and the nursery, and the umbilical cord is severed to some extent, and our identity is really forged and tested, and so we become more inquiring of the world, and we shape that identity, and I think we are just naturally more open to so many more things in our kind of formative tertiary educational pathways. And that's why I'm also quite worried about where the world is heading today, where things like critical race theory have really infiltrated institutions of higher learning, because I think we're so receptive at that particular phase of our journeys. But I don't want to go down that particular rabbit hole. How would you describe yourself personally? I mean, you leave it a little bit open-ended. You're probably not an atheist, judging by the way you view beauty in some of the Riemann hypothesis, for example, and the way you speak so passionately about love and personal failure and loss. How would you describe yourself?
Well, that's a tough question. I definitely believe that it is self-evident that Bertrand Russell was wrong. In being a lifelong atheist, he, in his final writings, you know, yearns, you can clearly see in his language, he was yearning for something quite mystical and quite divine to achieve in his life. And I point out to the reader that it's quite ironic how the greatest of atheists, including Christopher Hitchens, writes so beautifully about the divine, and they write such beautiful language. Christopher Hitchens may be less so, but certainly Bertrand Russell. So I definitely believe that there's something. Is that something particularly concerned with me, my life? Sometimes I feel that it is. So do I, as the famous song, as that very beautiful song by Nick Cave goes, I don't believe in an interventionist God, but baby, I know that you do. Mm. You know that beautiful song by Nick Cave. Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. So I definitely am not sure whether there's an interventionist God in my life. I often think that the patterns with which things occur in my life are something like the patterns of primes in the real number system or in the natural number system, which is to say that it appears to be random, but it's not.
Yeah.
It appears to be chaotic, but it's not. And that's why I compare pi to the Riemann hypothesis towards the back end of the book. People sometimes take this negatively, like bad things always happen in threes. But I find that it's very useful to think that a sense of moral good is not a cultural phenomenon. It's not just my way of getting along with other human beings, that it actually pre-exists me, that I search to achieve it. I find that I'll be a much better person if I believe that it's not just a cultural phenomenon. I find that the infinite beauty that we create with language, the fact that we have language and that we have creativity, and the fact that I can listen to Miles Davis play, which is completely an out-of-body experience. It's easier for me to believe that that comes from something outside of myself and outside of culture, that there is some inherent, innate, something otherworldly, something divine. But can I say that it is something that I can see less so? Can I prove it? Well, we can't prove the Riemann hypothesis even. So now you're asking me to prove that God exists. You know, so that's the point of the book, is to say, we don't even know where language comes from. We don't even know where numbers come from. We don't even know how primes are distributed. We can make machines that can count trillions of Riemann zeros. We can map every neuron in the brain, but that does not make the mind. You have to believe, surely, I'm saying to the reader, that there's an inherent beauty and pattern that is outside of us. I guess I am saying that.
Yeah. And I guess as well, in breaking free from the misinformation and the disinformation that seems to permeate the world today and it's engulfing us, you know, the Socratic method, the dialectic method sort of uncover objective truths through questioning. And there is a sense that throughout your life, you've sought to find some objective truth through questioning, through mathematics, through literature as well. But I think you also, towards the end of the book, open up quite deeply around failure. And you talk about grappling with failure, particularly in some personal mathematical pursuits. How has that failure contributed to your intellectual and your personal growth? Do you think it's important or even necessary for achieving kind of true orthogonal thinking?
Yes, I think so. I think something that is quite personal and which is difficult to talk about, but which a lot of people experience, is failure in relationships and failure in friendships and failure in romantic relationships. And it's why I like to call orthogonal thinking a love story, because in many ways it's about a failed relationship. And it's not that the other, and we all have, if you think about it, we all have. And this idea, by the way, comes from a postmodernist, but it's a useful idea still. We all have an implied other. When we're alone and we're speaking to ourselves in our head, or even if we're not articulating words in our head, if you think about it, in our daily lives, in our nighttime, in our darkest moments, in our funniest moments, in the way we laugh, in the way we have a certain way of moving, or we are always constantly actually observing ourselves in dialogue with another. And that other could be an ideal other, like some kind of version of our wives or of our mothers or of our sisters or of our brothers, or maybe an amalgamation of people. But we always try to impress and communicate with and be in dialogue with an other, whatever that other is, whether it's real or not. And in my life, I've had a failure to achieve a kind of real life version of an other. And I've had to create or superimpose expectations on people which they can't meet. So that's where the failure comes in. And it's quite humbling, I think, to search for and to acknowledge that I'm maybe not so perfect, and maybe the way I deal with people could be the common denominator. And that was what I'm hinting at in the book, which is it's all fine and well to have a sophisticated theory of how to read the world and how to have exceptional beauty in experience. But we, after all, are social animals, and the relationship that we have with other people is critical. And in my battle with finding meaning, the greatest battle has been to find a dialogue with another. That's quite a personal answer.
Yeah, it's a very personal answer. David, we are going to leave it there. On that note, I would encourage listeners to go and get a copy of Orthogonal Thinking. It's on the exclusive books recommended reading list for October. And we're really looking forward to the book launches. We're having one in Cape Town on the 26th, so that's next Thursday. And then we're going to have another one in Johannesburg on the 9th at Circa. And then on the 24th as well, we're having one in a bookstore as well. Well, that brings us to the end of today's Monocle Banking podcast. I hope you've enjoyed a very deep, very thought-provoking conversation with David Buckham as much as I have. Orthogonal Thinking, a truly remarkable journey through mathematics, through literature, through philosophy. But more importantly, I think it's just a reminder of the power of interdisciplinary thinking in trying to help us understand not just the world around us, but our own existence at the end of the day. So I'd like to thank David for sharing that wisdom and his personal journey with us, and encourage all of you to pick up a copy of Orthogonal Thinking, a book I think that will not only challenge your intellect, but also inspire you to just think differently about the stories that we live by.
Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.